thank you all for coming out this evening and braving this morning's snow. I appreciate you coming out also to talk about the war, listen to a talk about the war, participate in this discussion at a time when most Americans just want to sweep the war under the rug as yet another Bush administration nightmare that we are glad is over. Because, as we all know, the war is not over. It continues every day. And for those of us who have been through the war, it may continue for decades. And I am 31 years old. Many of the veterans of these wars are younger than me. And we will need help and support for the rest of our lives sometimes. On that note, I thought I would talk a little bit about how I came to be writing about this war, how I came to be writing about veterans. I'll give you an overview of the issues that are facing our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans. Then I'm going to talk about the battle that our wounded soldiers have to fight with the Pentagon before they even leave the military. And finally, I will talk about the battle that our veterans have to fight with the Department of Veterans Affairs to get adequate benefits when they get out. I went over to Iraq for the first time in April of 2003 as an unembedded journalist shortly after the fall of Saddam Hussein. I decided to go because I was sitting in my home in California during the lead-up to the war. And with all of the news coverage about this impending war, it didn't seem like anyone was talking about the Iraqi people. And it didn't seem like anybody was talking about the American soldiers who would fight in this war. It was as if there was going to be a giant arm wrestling match between George Bush and Saddam Hussein, and they were going to be the only people who were involved. And so I packed up my stuff. I went first to Turkey and Jordan. And when Saddam Hussein fell, I took a taxi cab into Iraq, an old orange and white checkered station wagon. And it didn't take me long to meet the U.S. military. On my very first day in Iraq, in my very first interaction with an American soldier, I was almost shot to death. I was pulling in to this checkpoint near the Palestine Hotel, and I was going to meet a friend of mine, James Longley, who's an independent filmmaker based here in Seattle, and he was in front of the Al-Fanar Hotel, which was on the other side of this checkpoint. As we pulled up to the checkpoint, there was an American soldier there, couldn't be more than 19 or 20 years old. He had a helmet too big for his head. He might have been from Alabama or Mississippi, somewhere in the deep south, a white guy. His helmet was clearly too big for his head, and he said, "Turn your car around." And I thought, well, I'm a journalist. I don't need to do this. So I got out of the car, and I thought, I'll talk to him. Well, that was a mistake. He sees me getting out of the car. He points his weapon at me, and he says, "Turn your car around." And at this point, I kept talking, and when he saw that I was kind of vaguely of dark complexion and had a mustache, he was even more convinced that I was someone not to be trusted, and he cocked his machine gun. And then I did another stupid thing. I reached for my wallet to show him my passport, and it all could have been over very quickly, except for the fact that I was with a French journalist at the time who happened to be blonde, and he stuck his head out the window, and he said, "Is there some kind of problem here?" And the soldier looked at him, saw his blonde hair, assessed that this was no longer a dangerous situation, threw his weapon over his shoulder, and waved us through the checkpoint. Well, suffice it to say that after that, I wanted to stay as far away from the American military as possible. And over my successive trips to Iraq, which spanned 3 years, I interviewed many, many Iraqis who had been on the receiving end of American firepower. I interviewed families whose relatives were imprisoned and tortured at Abu Ghraib. I interviewed people whose homes had been destroyed by the U.S. military. I was in Fallujah when the U.S. military bombed it, and so many Iraqi people were killed in Fallujah that the municipal stadium of Fallujah had to be turned into a graveyard for the dead. I saw the rotting corpses of civilians in Fallujah be carried off to the cemetery because they were rotting in the street because the battle had been so fierce that they could not be cared for and properly buried until it ceased. And I can remember those smells. And this was the kind of work that I did on and off for 3 years. And like I said, I never really had the opportunity to interact with the American military because they had guns, and because I was unembedded, they were kind of pointed vaguely in my general direction, and I wanted to keep them from being pointed directly at me. But when I came home, I began to connect with American veterans because I was going through some of the same things that our veterans go through when they get home. I had come home from Iraq, but I still thought about it all the time, and not just in terms of daydreaming. I was living nearby the ABC 7 News helicopter pad in Los Angeles, and every time the helicopter would go up and every time the helicopter would go down, I would feel like I was back in Baghdad. I had trouble sleeping at night. I had a lot of muscle aches and pains that I couldn't explain in any way, and I went to the doctor, and the doctor told me there was nothing wrong with me. But now I understand probably that I just had so much stress in my body from my time in Iraq that it was causing me tremendous physical pain. And when I would talk about these things with most people, it would just kind of freak them out, so I wouldn't talk about it at all. But when I would talk about it with American war veterans, I would find that we were going through pretty much the same thing. And especially when I would do radio interviews to promote my first book, How America Lost Iraq, which was published by Penguin in 2005, I found that the people who would call in with the most incisive comments, the people who made the most incisive questions, the people who would come to these events like the one we're having tonight, and where we could have the most interesting discussions away from the podium, were always veterans. Because even though we might have a different opinion about the war, at least we were talking about the same war that we had both experienced. And so that's when I started to write stories, just a few stories at first, and then I got a contract to write this book, The War Comes Home. And at first, that's all it was called, The War Comes Home. I wanted to write a book that would be relevant to family members of those whose sons or daughters or cousins or nephews had gone off to fight in Iraq and had come home changed, to explain what this change was. I wanted to write a book for veterans of the Vietnam and Gulf Wars to explain to them how this war experience was the same or different than their war experience. I wanted to write a book for the general American public that answered the question, what was it like? Which is a question that people always get asked after they come home from a war, but can only be answered in a book. So I set out to write this book that was just a listening expedition, but it didn't take long for me to understand that what I really needed to do was write a political book. And that's why I decided to call the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, because we make our veterans battle for every single benefit we promise them when they sign up. The first battle that our veterans have to fight is the battle just to be heard. I'm going to give some statistics. We have 1.8 million veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to the RAND Corporation, we have 300,000 veterans coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. We have another 300,000 veterans coming home with traumatic brain injuries. This is physical brain damage often caused by roadside bombs. We have 400,000 veterans of these wars who are already out of the military and have filed a disability claim, who say they are disabled from their wartime service. We have hundreds of thousands of American veterans who are already out of the military from these wars and using the VA's medical services, especially its psychological services. And these are statistics that we almost never hear in the media. And the reason we never hear them is because the Bush administration had been very careful to not tell us and to only give this information out to aggressive reporters and lawyers who sued to find out what these statistics were. Otherwise, there's no way that we would know that 80,000 Americans have had to be medically evacuated out of the country of Iraq or Afghanistan because their wounds were too severe to be treated on the battlefield. Under President Bush, people who spoke up and talked about these statistics and urged a public dialogue and urged the administration to do something were fired. Anthony Principi, George W. Bush's first Secretary of Veterans Affairs, came forward and said to George Bush, when he started this war in Iraq, "Mr. President, you have started a war. You need to hire more doctors. You need to hire more nurses. You need to hire more psychiatrists and disability claims adjusters at the VA." And he was fired. Dr. Francis Murphy, hired by the Bush administration's VA to do a mental health assessment to survey our VAs and figure out if they were doing a good job caring for our returning veterans. She found out that mental health care was so inaccessible as to be worthless. She was also fired. Who got promoted? Well, when Anthony Principi was fired as the VA secretary, a guy named Jim Nicholson was brought in. Jim Nicholson was a real estate developer from the great state of Colorado who had managed the Florida recount campaign of George Bush in the year 2000 and had no particular expertise in health care. Dr. Ira Katz, the head of mental health under President George W. Bush, when CBS News started to investigate the number of suicides amongst our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, Dr. Katz wrote an email to a VA spokesperson. The subject line was SHH exclamation point. He went on to say, "Don't tell CBS News that 1,000 veterans under our care attempt suicide every month. We have to find a way to spin this thing." That was the attitude of the Bush administration. Why did they have this attitude? Because they had to sell us the war. Remember Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense? I know he's not necessarily a fond memory. He told us that the war might last 6 days. It might last 6 weeks. He doubted 6 months. And here we are 6 years later. If he had told us that this war would go on for 6 years and we'd be looking at 400,000 disability claims, 18 suicides a day by veterans, if he told us that we would have 300,000 people coming home with PTSD and another 300,000 coming home with traumatic brain injuries, maybe we wouldn't have gone for this war. And so they did everything they could to sweep the war under the rug, to sweep the casualties under the rug. And this had a very material effect on our wounded veterans' ability to get care. Another thing that has had a very material effect on our veterans' ability to get care is their inability to get out of the military after they've completed their service. During the Vietnam War, we had a draft, and almost everyone who served in Vietnam had to serve one tour, and they came home 1 year to the day that they set foot in Vietnam. They were back on American soil. In this Iraq war, we have people going 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. We have 700,000 Americans who have served more than one tour in Iraq or Afghanistan. And this is not easy. This is not what human beings are meant to do, fight in wars forever with no goal in sight, no end in sight. And part of the problem is not only that we have stop loss, not only that the inactive ready reserve is being called up, it's also that the military has been under such pressure to get bodies to the front that they simply disregard requests of people when they ask for help. And when it becomes clear to them that a soldier is not able to function, the commanders often diagnose them with a personality disorder. We have tens of thousands of American soldiers who have been given dishonorable discharges for having a personality disorder after serving in Iraq or Afghanistan. In other words, people come home, they can't sleep at night, they start drinking, they start engaging in destructive behavior. The response should be from the military, this person clearly is suffering from combat stress and needs help. But instead, all too often, the military says, you have a pre-existing condition. You have always been crazy. You were crazy even before you went to Iraq, and now we're going to get rid of you and not give you any benefits so that we can make room for the next guy who's going to be more useful for us. Another thing that happens, that's happened to thousands of our veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, is that they come home from the war and begin to engage in destructive behavior, beginning to drink too much, beginning to do drugs, maybe get in a domestic violence incident with their spouse. The police have to be called. And then they get a dishonorable discharge for this behavior. I write in the book about Don Hanks, who was stationed down at Fort Lewis. He was a staff sergeant, served 14 years in the United States Army, including a tour in Iraq. Never had any problems over there 14 years. But after he got home from Iraq, he was trying to tough it out, started smoking marijuana, failed a urine test, and was dishonorably discharged with no benefits. Well, I talked to him about a year ago. He was cleaning the windows on skyscrapers here in Seattle, and he liked it. You know, he liked to be up above the city all by himself where he had some room to think and wash the windows. But he really needed to get into some kind of healthcare system, and that was unavailable to him because he had received this dishonorable discharge for failing this urine test. And the situation is even worse when the military doesn't want to let you go, when they force you to go back to Iraq, when they don't listen to you when you say you need help. I just finished writing an article about specialist John Fish, who lived in San Luis Obispo County on the central coast of California. He told the military that he was depressed during his first tour in Iraq when he was 17 years old. He came home. He told the military commanders that he was suicidal, and they didn't believe him. And they ordered him deployed to Afghanistan for his second tour. And so during the training exercises for his second deployment, he wandered out into the New Mexican desert and shot himself in the head. This is why we have more suicides now in the month of January than we did combat deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. I'm going to just read a little bit from my book now. This is from my chapter on suicide. It's the story of Brian Rand. He grew up on a military base, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Start out the story talking to his sister, April Somdahl, who owned a tattoo parlor outside the gates of Camp Lejeune. She told me how at the beginning of this war, everyone was coming into the tattoo parlor and getting patriotic tattoos, flag tattoos, American Eagle tattoos. Then after the war went on for a while, people started to come in and get meat tags. In other words, they come in and get their Social Security number, their Army ID number, literally tattooed on their body in case something should happen to them on the battlefield. It would be known who they were. Then people started to come in and get memorial tattoos. Memorial tattoos for their buddies who they'd lost in the war. Family members would come in to get memorial tattoos for their families. And she had a loss in her own family because her own brother, Brian Rand, committed suicide after he came back from one of his tours to Iraq. So I'll read his story. Brian Jason Rand was born on December 9, 1980, into a military family on base at Camp Lejeune. Throughout his life, he had always been in and around the military. He deployed twice to Iraq, returning for the final time on January 2, 2007. It was during his first tour that April first noticed the change. She chatted with him every night over the internet. In the afternoon, while it was nighttime in Baghdad, she would sit in front of her computer in North Carolina, hook up a microphone, and talk with her brother, trying to keep his spirits up. But she could tell her brother was having an emotional meltdown. He would say, "April, I'm having terrible nightmares," she said. He told me about nightmares, about dead Iraqis, their souls and spirits haunting him, following him, telling him to do stuff, and it got scarier and scarier. April said she talked Brian to sleep nearly every night during his deployment, trying to keep him alive by giving him something to live for. "I would talk to him in a very quiet voice and make sure not to make any sudden noises," she said. "I would tell him the grass is still green over here, the sky is still blue. Just close your eyes and picture the lawn that we laid on staring up at the sky, and it's still there. When you get back, when your job is done, when you do everything that they ask you to do, come back to me and we'll lay on the grass and we'll stare at the sky and we don't have to talk about anything." But Brian's return home from Iraq wasn't the end of his nightmares. He was emotionally unstable. He knew he had problems, his family said, and he sought help from the military. He filled out a post-deployment health assessment form admitting to combat-related nightmares, that he felt down or hopeless and had mood swings. When someone checks yes to these types of things, clearly they should be evaluated for mental help, his widow Dina Rand told Clarksville's Leaf Chronicle newspaper. But according to them, he never requested help. Brian Rand never had a chance to see a psychiatrist. Instead of giving him the help he needed, the Army deployed him to Iraq a second time. "We didn't have very many phone conversations at all during his last deployment," his sister April told me. "The phone calls only came when he was spiraling out of control, so it was very difficult to figure out what he was trying to communicate. When he returned to Fort Campbell for the final time in January 2007, his family said he had completely changed. He'd flip on a dime," his wife Dina told the Leaf Chronicle, describing scenarios in public and private that made him paranoid and agitated. The newspaper reported Dina said her husband was either intensely happy or desperately sad. There was no middle ground, which was nothing like the man she married, whom she described as a gentle person who would drop anything he was doing to help anyone. On February 8, 2007, Dina called the police when Brian started screaming at his stepdaughter, Cheyenne. Quote, "Mrs. Rand stated that her husband was yelling at her daughter," Officer Matthew Campbell wrote in his report for the Clarksville Police Department. "Mrs. Rand went upstairs to make him stop, and she stated that he turned and smacked her in the face. Mr. Rand was gone upon arrival." About that time, Brian called his sister April. He said, "Oh, I can see everything now, April. It all makes perfect sense. I know what I have to do. I have to die. I have to leave the physical realm and leave earth and go up into heaven and be part of the army of God. And I've got to stop this war and save my guys here. And the best way I can do that is up in heaven, because I can't do anything while I'm down here. April told me she tried to talk her brother out of suicide. She mentioned that Dina was pregnant with their first child together. That child was going to need a father, she argued. But Brian wouldn't listen. He said, "The baby will be fine," April told me. "The baby will be taken care of." And then he started talking about his favorite music, and then from his favorite music he goes to saying, "You're going to have to know this. You're going to have to know my favorite movie. When I am gone, you are going to want to watch my favorite movie, April. My favorite movie is Mousetrap." Less than 2 weeks later, on February 20th, 2007, the Clarksville police received a call about a body lying face down under the entertainment pavilion on the banks of the Cumberland River. In their report, officers Heather Hill and Jeff DiRico wrote that two citizens called the police and said there was apparently a male person laying on the ground with a gun beside him. We arrived on the scene, made contact with the body. The male was obviously deceased from apparent gunshot wounds. Shotgun was lying next to the body. Crime scene was established. Suspect's vehicle was towed to major crimes. Emergency services arrived on the scene and removed the body. Brian Rand's death was 100% preventable. He did not have to die. If he had gotten the care that he needed instead of being ordered deployed to Iraq again, he would probably still be alive today. Even when you get out of the military, when you are finished with your fighting, then our system requires you to fight yet another battle just to get into the Department of Veterans Affairs. If you come home from the war and have post-traumatic stress disorder and you want to get into that system, the very first thing that the government makes you do is fill out a 26-page form where you have to not only describe the traumatic incident which has traumatized you and your symptoms, but you also have to get letters from your battle buddies or your commanding officers corroborating that these incidents actually occurred. And people who help veterans fill out this paperwork advise them to file a Freedom of Information Act request on themselves and copy their congressman to make sure that they have all the documents on themselves that the government has on them. And then the veteran gathers all of this paperwork together and submits it to the VA regional office, which then sits on it. And the average wait time, if there's no disagreement between the veteran and the VA, is 6 months to 2 years. And if there is a disagreement, if the veteran decides that he or she wants to appeal this decision, is 4.5 years. The wait is so long that we now have 600,000 veterans waiting to find out if they are entitled to disability. We have, in the 6 months that ended on March 31st of last year, 1,500 veterans who died waiting to learn if they would get a disability check. And for our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, this wait time is critical, because it can be the time that they either recover from their war injuries or they spiral out of control. Now, I will give you an example. Specialist James Eggemeyer of Stuart, Florida, I tell his story in my book. He came back from Iraq with a back injury, a shoulder injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder. One of his jobs was to load the bodies of dead Iraqis and Americans onto helicopters after incidents that resulted in casualties that his convoys were involved in. And you don't come back from that the same. So when he first came back to Florida, he got a job at a car wash, making $8 an hour, because there's no special hero job for you when you get out of the Army. But he couldn't hold that job. His back hurt, his shoulder hurt, he had trouble standing for long periods of time. He had trouble relating to his boss. And when his boss refused to give him Memorial Day off, he quit and decided to file a disability claim. During the 8 months that he was waiting on this disability claim, he lost his house. He lost connection with his son. He was popping pain pills because he wasn't getting the care that he needed, and he crashed his truck. If it hadn't been for charity in his community giving him a new used truck, or a newsed truck as he called it, he would have literally been living on the street less than a year out of combat in Iraq. Now, I wrote a story about his case about a year ago, and Senator Bill Nelson of Florida saw it. Senator Nelson was so outraged, there was a homeless veteran living in Stuart, Florida, that he called the VA, and he asked about James. And wouldn't you know it, the VA suddenly decided to move his paperwork to the top of the stack. And he got his disability rating. And he got into the healthcare system. And now I just saw James as part of this book tour. I was in Atlanta. I can tell you that he's doing all right. He's recovering. He has a place to live now. He's reconnecting with his son, who is in the custody of his parents. He's still not able to work, but he's in the upward spiral instead of a downward spiral. And all it really took was for the government to do what it said it's supposed to do. But the problem is that our government is not set up to be friendly. It's not set up to say, welcome home. It's set up to battle our veterans. There was a lot of wonderful people working for the VA. Especially in a city like Seattle, we have so many people who are the leading national experts at post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, dedicated public servants working for the VA. Unfortunately, our government has contrived a level of bureaucrats to keep our veterans from getting to those doctors. It's as if you're standing on one side of the street and you say, I am a wounded veteran. I just came back from the war. I have post-traumatic stress disorder or I have traumatic brain injury. And there's somebody who works for the VA on the other side of the street whose entire job is to say, no, you're not. Prove it. And if you can't prove it to me, you're not getting a cent from this government. That doesn't have to be this way. If our government was only as friendly to our veterans as our IRS is to our taxpayers, we would be in much better shape. I know you're sitting there saying, but Aaron, I hate the IRS. But if you think about it for a moment, right now we're all getting our W-2s, our 1099s together. Put together our taxes, send it off. And if we tell the IRS that we deserve a refund, guess what? They'll send it to us. If we tell them that we owe them $842.16, they'll cash the check. And then later on, they'll come back and audit us. If it turns out we're lying, they'll fine us. If it turns out we told a really big lie, then we might even go to prison. But they don't withhold our refund while they check and make sure we're not lying. I mean, just imagine if the IRS was set up that way. What a disaster. But that is the way that our VA system is set up for our wounded veterans. I don't want to go on too much longer because I want to have time to take your questions, and I also want to have a time to invite up Seth Menzel from Iraq Veterans Against the War, who's going to tell you about the Coffee Strong GI Coffee House they have down by Fort Lewis. But I do want to talk a little bit about our new president and what we can hope and expect from him. The good news is that Barack Obama had a very, very good record in the Senate on this issue. And he had some very good campaign promises. And his appointee to head the VA, General Eric Shinseki, is a wounded combat veteran from the Vietnam War who stood up to Donald Rumsfeld at the beginning of this war. So all of that is good. On the other hand, we haven't seen anything yet from President Obama on this issue. I don't want to get too upset. The man has been president for only a month. The economy is collapsing around him, and there are a lot of other problems getting his attention. But maybe I'll just make a few suggestions. The first thing that I think that he should do is have his VA secretary, General Shinseki, get up in front of the cameras once a month and give a press conference where he talks about the casualties of this war, just like I did at the beginning of this talk. And he can have the same kind of charts and graphs that generals have when they talk about how great the war is going. And he can talk about all the people who have been hurt and what the government is doing to help them, and how the government is falling short or succeeding. I think that that would do wonders for encouraging the public to talk more about this war. And I think that the other thing that he can do is he can move towards ending this adversarial system that I've been talking about, move towards ending the battle that our veterans have to fight to get in the door once they come home. Before I invite up Seth from IVAW, I just want to read a little bit from the quote that I have at the beginning of my book from Abraham Lincoln, from his second inaugural address after the end of the Civil War. It's been really popular to quote Lincoln these days because it's the anniversary of his 200th birthday. And this quote from his second inaugural address, a little phrase of it is chiseled into the VA building in Washington, D.C. But like a lot of phrases that are chiseled on government buildings, they took this one little part of it out of context. And I think it means a lot more when you read the whole paragraph. Actually, it's only one sentence, but Lincoln had really long sentences. He said, "With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which we may do to achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." Thank you. So thank you guys all for coming. I am going to take questions in just a moment, but first I want to bring Seth up here. This event tonight is put together in part to be a benefit for the GI Coffee House, Coffee Strong outside Fort Lewis, and Seth from IVAW is just going to talk a little bit about that for a moment.
Hi. My name is Seth Menzel. I'm with Iraq Vets Against the War. I'm also the executive director of the GI Voice Project. GI Voice is the corporation that Coffee Strong falls under. Coffee Strong is a GI coffee house. This is something that that was very popular during the Vietnam War. There were many GI coffee houses all over the country that served GIs in different ways than how we are. But it is an anti-war coffee house just outside the gates of Fort Lewis. In addition to serving coffee, we provide GI rights counseling. if a soldier is, or any service member is having trouble with their chain of command or issues with the military, we have people on staff, people like Michael Williams over there, who can tell them how to get out of the trouble that they're in the military. We have links to mental health care, free mental health care for soldiers, and post-traumatic stress disorder counseling. Since we've opened, we generally serve quite a few soldiers every day. We're constantly in contact with these people, and they've been bringing us their problems. Just yesterday, we've doubled our hours so we can serve even more soldiers, and we're looking to acquire an office space, living space, and space to provide counseling, one-on-one mental health care counseling in the neighborhood just outside of Fort Lewis. So it's easy to think that here in the age of Obama that that we've won and that all of this is going to just get better. But the other day I received something in the mail from the Army that I want to read to you. It says, pursuant to Presidential Executive Order of 14 September 2001, you were relieved from your present reserve component status and are ordered to report for a period of active duty, which is not to exceed 400 days. And I would be, if I were to follow these orders, I'd be going to Afghanistan for to support Operation Enduring Freedom. I'm very fortunate that I have the resources available to me at the coffee house, people to counsel me on how to file an exemption and how to get me through this without being dishonorably discharged because of it. So I'm living proof that we're helping people, and with your support we can continue to help more soldiers and more veterans. So thanks.